I promised those of you who were here yesterday that I would say some things to conclude my story about the Yaquis and their Easter ceremonies. Now, I apologize to you who were not here yesterday, were not with me yesterday, for starting on something kind of in the middle, but I must do that for those who came back for that reason, especially. And then I will get on to talk about the sand paintings and the kachinas. The ceremonies, as I had begun to describe them in the period of Lent, began with Ash Wednesday, with the first of these chapayecas. Here you have a variety of these masked marchers, dancers, pictured here. I told you you can't take pictures of them, but some people were allowed to down in Tucson at Old Pascua, and then I was able to make copies of that. Then on the first Friday of Lent, the first chapayecas show up, and every Friday more and more of them, and the hostility between the Pharisees, that is, all the marching groups of the enemies of Christ, keeps building and keeps building. I spoke about the Tenebrae service on Wednesday night with the gradual extinguishing of the 15 candles and then the ritual whipping ceremony. I spoke also of before the ritual whipping, there was the search for Jesus in the forest. The forest was in the church, in that Yaqui church. Thursday now is where I want to pick it up. At about noon on Thursday, there is a ceremony that was very interesting for me. It is called the Pursuit of the Old Man. There is an old man who is not shown on here, but he's one of these chapayecas. The one I saw wore a mask of a very old wrinkly face and a mop. So he had this long white hair, you know. And he on a cane, and he's all bent over and like that all the time. The old man. Now, this old man takes us back to the ancestors, the immortal ancestors of the forest, and represents them, the immortal ones. But at the same time, this old man in the ceremony I'm about to describe will represent Jesus. And now the enemies of Jesus are going to capture this old man. So they go out. Watch me go back and forth here and see how I can do. They go out into this area by the church cross. And they are all in formation. And he kind of wanders out into this space around the church cross. And they keep throwing little lariats at him until they finally get one around him. And then they drag him around, and he stumbles around until finally he falls, and he gets up and falls again. And eventually then they start a procession in which they lead this man as though he were on a leash. They lead him from this church cross area out to station one of the cross. Like a puppy dog in a way, but he's very having a hard time standing up. So once they get there, however, he gets down. One of the chapayecas that was leading him drops the leash and gets down on hands and knees right in back of the cross, and then the old man sits on him with his back to the cross, and then they make some prayers. And then meanwhile, all the other chapayecas lie down, face down on the ground, in the dust, in a line. And the old man takes a willow switch and switches each one of them. So this turning around the power around. First they got him, then now all of a sudden they are submitting to him. And this is the old immortal ancestors and Jesus at the same time in the back and forth. Having switched each one of them, they will all get up, they'll pick up the leash again and drag him on to the next station and do that all the way around the stations of the cross. By the time they finish, of course, he is stumbling and falling all the time and he is just a mess. And he reaches out to the people and pantomimes as though he's begging for someone to be helpful to him and so forth. Finally, then, they just tie him up on a leash out in front of the church like a tethered animal for a while. That is the capture, the pursuit and the capture of the old man. He stays there then for several hours, and they will occasionally, as they go by, mock him or something of that sort. So you keep the Jesus story and the passion in mind. Late that afternoon, they begin to go out and build in this area right over in here. They build a green bower. They have a little wooden framework, and they start bringing these huge limbs in out of the forest and build a kind of forest hut right there, covered with the branches. And then they bring a little table out like this in there. And then they have a procession where the church people bring an image of Jesus the Nazarene. Jesus clothed in beautiful purple garments. And they set that on there. And then they set up a church guard around that. That is, the church people, those who are friends of Christ, are guarding this bower for a while. Then come the marching armies. They march, they march, they stalk around this thing in a very organized, stomping fashion until finally they take these sticks that we saw the Chapayucas holding, those long swords, and they poke through this thing and eventually tear some of it down, exposing the image of the Nazarene. They put a little leash around that image, one on this from this side, one from the other side, and then they carry that back into the church. They have captured Jesus the Nazarene. So two different ceremonies that day portray the capturing of Jesus. They then will set a guard. They eventually release the old man just before this ceremony. And then they take this image into the church, set it on a table, and they have two of these Chapayucas guarding it all the night, all through the night, on Thursday night. Now, the mornings are spent getting new materials ready and all the things they're going to need for that day's ceremony, so there's a lot of work being done. But on Friday, we have at noon one of the first really important ceremonies, when the church people begin a procession around the stations of the cross. And of course, whenever the church people do the stations of the cross, the Pharisees, the Pharisees, and the Chapayucas and all of those follow along and flank them and make sure everybody behaves properly. And they go along and they don't pay much attention to the prayers, but there's quiet and reverence and standing in the proper position as they go along. As they go around this time, they go around until they come to station number 11, which you notice is a little different, isn't it? So station number 11 here is Calvary. And when they get there, in the procession they have a large wooden cross about so big. And in this procession, they carry one with the corpus, the body of Jesus, on it. And then the sacristan who carries it will stand himself right back to the wooden cross that's standing there in the yard. So there he is. And as the people then are doing their prayers, led by the maestro, Chapayucas comes up around behind like this and takes his dagger and taps on that wood three times at the feet. And this is the moment of the crucifixion. The crucifixion of Jesus is being here reenacted, and the feeling of that whole thing as you're involved in it and kneeling and praying and this is happening really brings you back to the foot of the cross. After they finish the stations of the cross there, they take then this crucifix that has been carried and they mount it in the floor of the Yaqui church, in that dirt floor inside there. And there we have now portrayed, displayed, the crucified Jesus. Then the Chapayecas and the Pharisees in general make a round, I didn't get to see this for some reason. I think they just kind of run around wildly and tear up all the crosses in the stations and cover them with cottonwood boughs, hiding the crosses at this time. Then later that afternoon, and I did get to see this, a procession begins out of the church, led by the church people again, and it goes out through the plaza here, and I noticed that, I didn't know where we were going, what we were doing at the time, but we followed over here and got into the backyard of these houses over here. I had to go around some fences to get in there. Boy, was that a mess over there. There were chickens all over the place, and you know what that means. And there were dogs barking at the people and all these kinds of things. They just come right on in there and go in there. And here I saw a great big, I'd suppose a 10 or 12 foot egg, it looked like, made of paper mache, or rather I guess it wasn't so much paper mache as it was chicken screen with crepe paper tassels in it. So it was, a crepe, like you'd make a float on, my words aren't coming right for that one, but like you would make a float for a parade. And that's how they made this very colorful egg. And on top of it was sitting a paper mache hen. All right, what in the world is an egg doing here? And eventually, after all sorts of commotion over there, they picked that thing up and carried it, then about six or eight men, carried it in the procession back into the Yaqui church. Well, by that time, of course, I'd figured out what it was. It was two things. An egg, the egg served as a kind of casket, a bier for Christ, for the body of Christ who had been crucified. And at the same time, it had the symbolism of the new birth. So the egg is both the casket and the sign that it will not hold him long. And they carried that back into the church. And then they have very detailed ceremonies of putting the image of Jesus off the altar inside this casket. So I did get to see that one. And then they carried it around in one more procession where the crosses had been, and that was to be the burial of Christ. Now, I'm going to move to Friday night. These things that I've been describing were happening noon and late afternoon. Now Friday, late at night, about midnight, after lots of prayers and lots of just plain militant marching of these groups out in the plaza, they began a procession around the ways of the cross again, this time always poking around in all those limbs. Remember, the crosses are down, laying down, covered with greenery, poking around in them, and then they would pray anyway and move on to the next one, poke around in those and then pray and then go on to the next that way. It was the people searching for Christ, because even though they knew he had been crucified, and here's what one of them told me, there's a rumor out that he's alive. And so they are searching, and they go the whole circuit of the cross twice, and then it's as though they're about to give up. They start a third time around, and halfway around on the third time, and they get about over here to seven or eight, all of a sudden somebody comes running and starts whispering to one person, and then he whispers to others, and pretty soon there's a lot of whispering going on. And then all of a sudden, people run in all directions, coming back down these streets, these gravel, dusty streets, just running like crazy, everybody. And they, until everybody, it's a little farther than it looks on this diagram, until everybody has come back around like this and into the church. They are running because the word is out. He is alive. Jesus is alive. So after midnight on Good Friday, about 1 o'clock or so, 1:30, this happened. I got the warning in time to stay out of that one. And they said, if you're not used to what's going on right now, stay out of it because you might get hurt. People fall, stumble and fall. Others come along and just grab them and drag them up. It doesn't much matter. I mean, it's so important that this thing be done that you don't have a right to fall and stay down. Well, that was about it for that night. And then Saturday. In the morning, the Chapayecas had a great big image of Judas. And Judas is called the patron saint of the Chapayecas. And they were still trying to pretend that they had Jesus and that they were the winners. Eventually, they put Judas out about where the church cross was supposed to be. And they tear that down and put Judas up there. This big papier-mâché, or I don't know what kind of image of Judas that they have, about 9-10 foot tall, dressed with crazy hat and all that stuff. That Judas is their patron. And by noon, the villagers and friends and people, relatives who've left the village years and years ago are back, at least for this climax now of the annual ceremonies. And so there are hundreds and hundreds of people, of the Yaquis and the Mexicans and the Mayas and the white folks coming from Phoenix, and everybody is hanging around the outside edges of the plaza now for the finale. About noon, we begin to find that the village people are gathered, or the church people are gathered up in here, and along with them, some of those fiesta dancers, Pascolas, and the deer dancer, they're gathered up in front of the church, and they're tearing off from flowers. They're big buckets full of flower petals. Others are sitting around cutting confetti into little tiny pieces, filling many, many buckets full of these kinds of things, because this flower petals and this little confetti is really flowers. They call it flowers, even though it's paper, is reminiscent of, it is the drops of Jesus' blood. For they tell the story that when Jesus suffered and died on the cross, the blood drops that hit the ground became flowers. And it is the blood of Jesus that finally must defeat these enemies out there. So as the time went on, then the great marching groups came out. Now they're all in black and wearing veils, and it really looks threatening, except for the Chapayecas. They still wear the same old silly things, you know, but it's really threatening the way they march. And as this is all going on in front of the church, all of a sudden, instead of a marching step, they rush at the church. And as they rush, all the people gather up flower petals and with smiles on their faces and everything, they throw these flower petals at these people who are charging at the church. And immediately they turn around and run back to the other end of the plaza. Pretty soon they regroup and they do a little more negative militant marching. And then all of a sudden they charge again, a second time. The same thing. And then the third time they are turned away with the flower petals. And that is the final defeat of Jesus, the blood of Jesus, defeating the power of all those powers against him. And at that point, we all of a sudden have somebody has. Somebody has lighted a fire. I'll come back to him later. Somebody has lighted Judas on fire. And all the Chapayekas bring those masks and the swords, wooden swords and knives, and all the paraphernalia that has been used in the 40 days of the Lenten ceremony is all piled up at the base of this Judas, and gasoline is poured over the whole thing, and this whole thing goes up into what I saw was flames that you couldn't even see Judas. I mean, it was just huge flames. But I know that my own feeling, I had been around those Chapayekas so many hours, and I had grown so fond of the feeling that they projected. And some of these were animal heads, real animal skin head made with great care. Some of them were pieces of wood, so delicately carved and painted. And I had to cry just a little bit to see all that now put in there. But it was all contaminated with the powers of evil. And it all had to be destroyed for the safety and welfare of the community. Except, I believe one Chapayeka head is saved each year, almost as though it is the seed for the next year's ceremonies. And then some old ladies ran out from the sideline and took these men who had been Chapayekas for all these weeks, took them by the arm and ran back into the church with them. Here, you saw these Indian men now without their masks for the first time in all these weeks, and the sweat and dirt running down their faces and down their bodies, and these women run into the church with them for a quick ceremony of purification. About 15 minutes later, those were called sponsors. These are the women who are the sponsors of these individuals. Run into the church for a purification. And it was just so clear in the community that these were our heroes. These are the heroes who made it work. The ones who made the ceremony that needed to be done every year to renew the community. The death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ celebrated once again. And so while that was going on, in front of the church, the Matachinas began to play their music and sing, and their dancing started. And over on the other end of the plaza, another little musical group begins to work at it, and the deer dancer begins to dance. Fiesta time is here. What we just described was the Gloria, that is the third turning away, and thus the victory of Christ is the beginning of what they call the Gloria. And that is the beginning, actually, now of Easter. And so from here on, it's all celebration. All night, the dancing goes on. Not too many people stay around, but some. And the Matachinas dance most of the night, taking a few breaks now and then. The fry bread stations are all open around, and you can go buy some food and some drink and keep some Cokes and things and keep going. Deer dancer will dance all night, and the Pascola dancers will dance all night. And then the next day in the morning, there is a service of celebration, which I didn't get to go to because I had to preach that Easter morning someplace else. But they'll have another celebration service, and so it all kind of dies down about noon. And it ends with the head maestro, the head teacher of the Yaqui people, standing out in the middle of the plaza and making a speech which basically starts like this. You ask what this is all about. And he makes then an explanation of how long our people have done this and why it has to be done and what it has done for us once again to do these ceremonies. That is the story, yes? Okay, I'll stay with that one. That'll be something else. Your questions that you might like to, I've used about half of the time to finish that up. Yes.
Are there any other Indian tribes?
I would say that the detail, he's asking, are there other tribes that go to this much detail? Every Indian ceremonial that I have ever studied has a detail which is just unbelievable. Because it is in that detail that all of the things that are being done are a kind of meditation. They are spinning you through a whole set of meanings. The details are not there for their own sake, but they are there for what they teach. So you're surrounded with hundreds and thousands of details. Nobody can concentrate on all of them. But nonetheless, the symbols are there, and they're pounding away at your consciousness all your life. So yes, the detail is amazing. Yes?
Are there several Yaqui churches do this, or is this basically the one in Guadalupe?
This is the one in Guadalupe that does this. There are three down in Tucson. The first one that we know about, Old Pascua, and the second one, New Pascua, and I understand there is a third smaller barrio down in Tucson that also has the ceremonies. But the two that I know for sure. And they still do them down in Mexico, because in those eight village towns along the river, there has been some reestablishment down there, and apparently they do them there. Well, the Plains Indians, especially the South Dakota Oglala Sioux, that I talked about them a couple days this week, and you don't see the explicit Christian things in those ceremonies. However, Black Elk, who told us so much about these ceremonies in his Black Elk Speaks and especially in The Sacred Pipe, The Seven Rites of the Oglala Sioux, Black Elk himself was a Roman Catholic and wanted to reach back and preserve the tradition as well. So he was kind of both. And his interpretation of some of the points is, I believe, considerably influenced by his Catholic upbringing, his way of interpreting some of their beliefs and some of the practices in the ceremonies. But no, in the Plains Indians, I don't see this kind of syncretism, this bringing together of the Indian and the Christian ceremonials. I don't see that. There may be some of it that's beginning to happen, where they're bringing, I know that some of it is happening now, recently, as priests, Episcopalian, Roman Catholic priests, and are working with some of the Indian people to use the pipe, the sacred pipe, as a symbol also in the Holy Eucharist, and to bring some of the other symbols of that tradition into their Christian celebrations. I have no detail to give you on that. Yes? How were they prevented? Well, you had your Bureau of Indian Affairs with its agents on the reservations, and it was just a no-no. And they were afraid that if you got the Indians together to do their traditional things, that there might be an uprising. Now, I don't really have the picture absolutely clear myself about how that worked, because the Yaquis were doing these these Easter ceremonies from about 1910 or a little before that on an annual basis. Almost all the time, I think, in these villages of Arizona. But it was in the plains, especially, where they were worried about the so-called Indian uprisings. And so it was illegal for them to gather and do these ceremonies. Well, there are some similarities. I suppose one most common one, which I tribe to tribe, nation to nation of Indian peoples. The fact that Indian people find this to be a universe full of personal beings where plant people, animal people, tree people, especially fly, the winged people that fly, and the swimmers, and that sort of notion that the universe is a universe of personal beings. That's common, I think, everywhere. But then you'll get a lot of variations. In the plains groups, you have Vision Quest, Sweat Lodge. Sweat Lodge in some of the others too, but used a little differently. Visions are sought in other ways in some other parts of the country. So there are some similarities, but you cannot talk about Indian religion. You really have to talk about Indian religions and then observe the similarities and notice the differences as well. The wheel is very common, again, through the Plains Indians. Everything is the circle. And the sacred circle, some words are escaping me that I want to describe that. The sacred wheel has to do with the cardinal directions, and the circle has to do with the unity and harmony of everything and everybody. So within that circle, the meaningful symbols of life take shape, and that's fairly widespread, the symbol of the sacred circle. Again, especially plains people work with that circle a lot. Let me, for the sake of those of you especially who came because I said I was going to do something about sand paintings and kachinas, let me move on to do some of that. Is the light too bright for that? Marlon, if you would close that door, I believe that would be. Oh, we can't. Okay, that's all right. Maybe it's not too bad, huh?
It's fine.
You can see it all right. All right, we'll just let it go at that. How many of you have been in parts of the country where you have seen sand paintings for sale in craft shops, art shops, and so forth? Most people, I suppose, have. The first thing to remember about them is that once upon a time, that was forbidden. And the reason it was forbidden is because you made sand paintings on the floor of a ceremonial hogan house, eight-sided house. That ceremonial hogan was a universe. It's the universe, the whole universe in microcosm. And the painting was made there for the purposes of a healing ceremony. And so the idea of gluing the sand onto boards so that white folks can take it back to their Indiana homes and hang it on their walls, that idea took a long time, but there was money in it. And so what they decided eventually, the compromise, first it was just plain blasphemy to do such a thing. But somewhere along the line, there evolved a rationale that allowed it. And the rationale said that you mustn't reveal the full, complete, truthful picture. So you had, the artist now had to put a flaw into the picture. Something that would not have been quite that way if it was being used in its ceremonial setting. And that meant that as soon as the flaw went into it, it was a profane piece, an ordinary piece. It no longer was holy and sacred anyway. So then you can put whatever price on it you can get. But the important thing to recognize is that art, for the sake of art, is our idea. Indian art was always for the sake of symbolic meaning. It was always art in action, art in use. The sticks and everything that had beautiful carvings on them were for use, not to be looked at, just to be looked at. Or your art work on the tents or on the shields or wherever it was. So symbols are always symbols in action, symbols in use. Now, what is this thing about sand paintings? We're talking especially now about Navajo, the Navajo people in northern Arizona. I just want to say a word or two about their gods, goddesses, and so forth. There is, of course, a very long, drawn-out story about creation, I guess you could say. It starts with their emerging out of four levels beneath the earth, almost as though in the bowels of the earth they began to have a life, and it didn't go right in the first world, and so they emerged up into the second world. It didn't work right there, and they merged up into the third world, and then into the fourth world. So they were created then, and the world and the landscape in which they were created is after all that emergence. And we talk about their creation myths as emerging. Of course, the symbolism is there, isn't it? Out of Mother Earth, out of the womb of Mother Earth, this creation comes forth. And then, as they are now in this world, there are certain gods that were especially important to them. One is called Changing Woman. She is a very creating being. She creates a lot. And then Sun is a creating god. The twin war gods and Monster Slayer. There are a number like this that we would classify as the great gods. They are very powerful in the final details of making this world, making it the way it is. Then there were a whole lot of others that are called the Ye. These, I guess you would say, are usually it gets translated as the holy people, which means they were special kinds of beings, not really human beings in the fullest sense. They were special kinds of beings that were created in the earliest part of the creation process, and they actually represent spiritual forces, spiritual powers. You could say spirits, spirit beings, but spirit beings associated with certain things in the landscape. A spirit being associated with a certain healing herb. Herb, I guess you're supposed to say. A spirit power associated with a certain spring, with a certain lake, with a certain mountain peak, and all these different kinds of things. These are and there are just innumerable such yay. Little spiritual powers of water, fire, wind, thunder, lightning, plants, animal powers, all of that. Now, somewhere along the line, a person has been called by one of these yays, one of these spiritual powers, into another world. And there has been taught a whole ceremonial for healing certain kinds of things that go wrong in human lives. So a person has been taken into that world and initiated, shown in events, shown the power that brought the evil into our lives, and shown the solution to those powers. So they've been taught songs, they've been taught stories, they've been taught paintings, sand paintings. And in that way, this person we might call a spiritual leader, or I suppose most anthropologists would immediately go to the name medicine man. Somebody has been initiated by spiritual powers through a vision into a cure for certain things that go wrong in human life. So, from now on, when such things go wrong, that person in whose life there is this need goes to a person who is now called a singer, because there is so much to sing in this ceremonial, goes to the singer and requests the ceremonies. Okay, it's a big deal. Once you've made that request, you better know what you're doing, because there are going to be relatives and friends coming from all over the place to freeload on you for 7, 8, 9 days as the ceremonies go through the days and nights of 7, 8, 9. And all these folks are around and have to eat. And somehow the sponsoring families, extended sponsoring families, have to make sure that goes all right. And the singer is going to have his specialized services paid for, and he gets a little something for doing this. But now you have the singer, the patient, I'll call him. He maybe is sick, maybe mentally, emotionally, maybe socially stigmatized, or anything that might be wrong in the harmony between himself and this world is going to be the thing that is being attended to here now. So in that process then, the singer knows what sand paintings were revealed as part of the healing process for this particular ailment. So on certain days of the ceremonies, sand paintings are created inside the hogan, this eight-sided house, facing east, and the thing might be 8 to 10 feet in diameter, this painting, inside this room, and the people working on it around the edges and others sitting back in the farthest edges. So you have to paint this thing, and while it is being painted, the singer is reciting stories, chanting stories and songs, and the ones who are actually doing the work of making the painting, well, so much to add in there. They had to first get the powder, that is the sand, the colored sands. And there are certain standard colors that they are allowed to use, and those colors have to do with the four cardinal directions and all kinds of symbolism. They have to go to the mountains and find the right kinds of rocks. Their family has to spend days, months, grinding these rocks into, pulverizing this into sand. And then they have these little vessels with them, and they pick it up by hand, and they draw these perfect lines with it by hand. They will use a taut string, perhaps, to create the line in the fresh white sand that they use as the base. But then freehand all the rest of this. Now, they will be drawing things on there. They will be putting things into this painting that actually reminisce the story of the vision. The vision that brought this healing is going to now be pictured. So you've got a myth, and you've got the physical representation in this art form of that story. And if even as there were powerful spiritual beings in that story, so those powerful spiritual beings are now going to be in this picture. And when you paint one of them, you are bringing that spiritual force right here. It's here now. Real presence. Really present. So the singing and the painting brings all these powers that are associated with this ceremony, it brings them right here. When it comes to a certain time, the patient will call that person still. It doesn't always have to do with physical ailments. But the patient is brought to sit in the very middle of the painting. Now, made of sand, you know that immediately begins the process of messing it up. But that's what it's for. To sit in the middle of it is to be sitting in, a circle, which is a universe. It is at the same time to be sitting in the midst of all those special powers that were created to deal with this particular problem. And then a dancer, a yay dancer in mask, comes in from outside and dances around with herbal medicine and anoints this person with it and rubs some more of it on his own hands and then starts picking up sand in various parts of the picture and rubbing that sand, see the wet hands from the medicine, and combined with the sand from the various parts of the picture, rubbing that on certain parts of the body of the patient, applying the holy power that's in the painting to the person, cleansing, symbolically cleansing the person of the evil forces and evil powers that were there, so that they are taken away into the sand as it falls off his body. So applying the painting with its powers to the person takes away the negative stuff and fills the person with the positive, the harmony, the balance, the health, the healing, the good powers. Details, there are many, many details, of course, in all of that that are just, I obviously don't have time to mention. Then when it's all done, they must gather all this sand up and put it in a container of some kind, and then it is taken off back out into the country, out where it came from in some way, shape, or form. And that's like taking the holy power and the negative, both negative and positive powers, taking them now away. Usually a ceremony called a blessing way or a night way ceremony or something like this that goes for 7, 8, 9 days, there'll usually be about 3 nights in a row where there will be sand paintings necessary. 3 days in a row where there will be a sand painting made and destroyed as part of the same extended process. Well, that in short, and I mean short, is what sand paintings are. Let's look at a few more. This one is called Whirling Logs, and there are beautiful extended stories about the vision of this. In the middle is a bowl, which is a bowl of water, which is the lake at the center of the world. And out of that lake comes the four logs, which represent the four cardinal directions. Out of that lake there grows the four vegetables. In the story it says that they're all corn stalks, and this one I don't think that's true. I think there's some beans and some squash and some other things here. But anyway, from the waters of the world come the farming crops. Sitting on the logs are a male and female yay, these spiritual forces, these little spirit beings. Sitting on this side, because it moves in a sunwise manner, a clockwise manner. And when it, each of them, these are upside down, because when they get over here, they're upside up. This is movement. And then you have certain god beings in the guarding the south, and then, excuse me, the west and the east. I know that's east because it's open at the top. Whereas none of the rest of this is open, is it? So you've got humpback deities on this side, which represents some wild powers, of course. You've got a rainbow being all the way around. You've got a head and hands up here with certain symbols there, and then the feet and skirt over there. And so this is called whirling logs. And of course, then if you see this sort of thing in a store, you see it in somebody's house, you know that there is this enormous ceremonial that was connected with this. There are stories and songs that could take days and nights to recite, to sing, as part of the healing. Now we'll just run through some others. I don't know the name of this one. This is probably another version of this, the whirling log. Oh, that. I watched a man do that in a museum. An Indian was brought in to do a sand painting about 3-4 feet wide, 6 feet long. He was just working away at it, and people would come and go and watch. But to watch that person make these perfect lines, I thought it couldn't be done, or that there was some special instrument, but it just through his fingers that he was able to do this. I'm impressed. All kinds of different sand paintings. And so without explaining them, we just simply have to know, remind ourselves that they are very complex and that they are part of healing ceremonies. Kachina ceremonies are the Kachina dolls. How many of you register that when you hear about Kachina dolls? Maybe a few more of you will join that when we show a few. That's starting to look any more familiar in museums and of the Southwest especially, or any Indian museums. All over the country I find they have these Southwest Kachinas. These are connected with the Hopi Indians, whose reservation is right up in the middle of the large Navajo reservation. You have these mesas where the Hopi are relatively small groups compared to the Navajo. But one of the cities up there is probably the oldest continuously inhabited city in this whole country. The Hopi have these kachinas. Now what you're looking at are carved kachina dolls, which are used as educational features for children. But in the life of the Hopi villages, these kachinas are the spiritual powers of certain things in the natural environment, again, or represent the spiritual powers of certain things in our lives. So during a certain time of the year, kachinas live on the San Francisco peaks, which are not too far away. And then at other times of the year, that slide I hustled past at the beginning nicely divides up the year into the kachina ceremonies in the village, and then other kinds of ceremonials another time of the year, but we don't have time for that liturgical calendar. So here you have different kinds of kachinas. They represent, for instance, certain kinds of human sin, and they represent certain kinds of human wisdom to punish that sin or drive it out or overcome it. And then you have clowns, and clowns like around here, when there's clowning, it always shows us something about ourselves, and the clowns do something to show us about ourselves. Either they do something really ugly, vulgar, and obscene, or wicked, mean, or they do something tender or sad, or something like this, but they always teach us something about what we are, what human nature is. And we can laugh at them, and at the same time we have learned, yes, that's what we are. And then there are always remedies for these things. So there are hundreds, and I suppose many more than that, different kinds of kachinas representing plant powers and animal powers and these various aspects of our own. I don't know which one looks most like the one I want to talk about. The ceremonies now in which these kachinas are the dancers, that is, human beings dressed in these kinds of costumes according to a certain tradition, perform dances at certain times of the year. There are plaza dances outdoors, daytime usually, I think. Then there are kiva dances. A kiva is a kind of underground room which you enter from the top with a ladder. Go down into the kiva. And it's a ceremonial room down there where certain kinds of dances take place at other times of the year. And here an artist has tried to draw us a kiva with the dancing going on. Here would be the outside of the kiva. Here you are on the top of one of these mesas, and the kind of the houses are built into all over there. And in the midst of this whole thing, here's a kiva where the ceremonies go on down below. And so during the ceremonies, people are going in and out, and dancers are going in and out at certain times. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Of all the Indian ceremonials I've seen, the one thing they're not, and that's in a hurry. They take days and nights to do these things, and as long as it takes, that's how long it takes. And when you start on Indian time, You start promptly whenever you get around to it. When you go to visit something like this, you better cast all concern for clocks aside, because you may just wait for hours for something to start that you thought was going to start about sundown. Because one person who's supposed to be dancing isn't here yet. Whenever he gets here, then we'll get this thing going and do it. But it'll need to be done. We came upon a dance. We came upon a Kachina dance as we were driving through the Hopi territory, my wife, who's knitting back there someplace, and my two children, and I, in the spring of 1984. And it was on a Sunday. We were driving through, and we heard that there were dances in the plazas. And so we parked our car with a camper behind it, about as high up as we could get, and then we hiked up the rest of the way to what is the Shipalovi that we went to up there. Way up on the top of this, you got your mesas, and then your mountain that goes up higher, and houses built around the top of that, and in the middle of that, a kind of plaza area. Just before you enter the plaza area, there's a big hole over there which went down into a kiva. So we come up here, and the dance is on hold right now. It's a rest time. And so we walked around and started to come into the area where the dance plaza was. And we see nothing but Indian faces, but maybe one or two white faces. I wasn't sure at first. Talk about what it feels like to be in the minority all of a sudden, not be absolutely positive whether you're going to be welcome or not. And we no more walked in there to take a look, and here come three clowns. Would that be what we'd call them, Marlene? They were of the clowns, weren't they? What? Were they? Black and white? They weren't, were they? No, they were dressed in short hanging things and a lot of corn pollen color on their chests. But their faces were unmasked. And they were obviously in the business of entertaining the group between the dance periods. And they came, two of them I think it was, came rushing directly over to me, saying, "We want you to come down here in the middle." God. I hadn't even taken my ball cap off yet. And we just got here. Don't understand what's going on. And they left me just that quick and went right over to her. And confronted her the same way. "Come on, come on." And then they said, "What? We teach you to dance." And we hadn't even caught our bearings yet. Well, they succeeded in convincing her to go out there, and on the way out said, "We teach you butterfly dance." And then once you got out there, you saw what was going on. They had a whole bunch of white people, about 10 of them or so, in a circle, and they said, "This is the Hopi version of musical chairs." And so then they did this musical chairs game their way, and poked fun at themselves and at white folks and at each other, and it was very entertaining. And mostly I think that ceremony was to be entertaining. So my wife danced for the Indians. And then pretty soon the dancers came up out of the kiva in these awesome costumes. Those dolls. But these are all identical now. And this was at the early toward the corn planting season, I think. And I took it that what we were seeing was spirits of the corn to make the corn grow. And they formed a line, and they did a line dance. But first there had to be a cornmeal dedication of the space and a cornmeal blessing. Cornmeal was being thrown on their feet and around this. Offerings were being brought in. And I want so bad to tell you all that detail, but it's not, there isn't time for that. But really what happened here was when they danced, you felt by looking at the faces of the Hopi people, you felt what they felt, and that was the real presence of these spiritual forces that create our food for us, that make things grow. You knew you were in the presence of those spiritual beings. And of course they were brothers and uncles and fathers of these people around, but they didn't know who was who unless they recognized toenails or something like that in the dust. But they were, when they dance, they are the powers. The powers are there, and their own personality is gone and insignificant at least. So we felt that power, and then the people brought gifts, and then they danced, and after the dance, the kachinas took these baskets of food and gave them to certain people in the crowd. And that was obviously a very special thing to receive these. Well, kachinas. When you see kachina dolls, remember behind those dolls there are spiritual beings that represent something important in the food supply or in the personality or in the whole business of impurity and purity. Something is being represented spiritually through those kachinas.